Former President Eisenhower tonight is calling on his fellow Republicans to wage war on President Kennedy's domestic program. He is denouncing what he calls government by Big Brother, and he is attacking the administration's massive spending programs and the concentration of power in Washington. General Eisenhower is making his first major speech since leaving office at a Republican fundraising dinner at the Washington Armory. 6,000 people are gathering for the kickoff of the 1962 congressional campaign. The text of the former president's speech was released 3 hours in advance of delivery. General Eisenhower is saying that the proposals now flowing in such abundance to Congress can lead to nothing but greater centralization. He says the Republicans take their stand with the individual who is better able to plan his own life and spend his own money. He points to the administration farm program as one which would substitute coercion for cooperation. He says federalized youth programs, public power, and excessive public housing are examples of what he calls the insulting concept of government by Big Brother. General Eisenhower continues, "I look in vain and with deep concern for fiscal responsibility today in public affairs. As I note the mounting expenditures, I often think how easy it is to buy things when you're spending the other fellow's money." The former president deals more gently with the administration's actions in the field of foreign affairs. Taking note of the forthcoming Vienna meeting, he is saying that President Kennedy has the hopeful and sympathetic goodwill of all Americans, regardless of party. He says we cannot allow the nation's basic unity of purpose to be in doubt. General Eisenhower is cautioning Republicans against choosing up sides now in the next presidential race. He says the present job is to win the next Congress. This is Ned Brooks.
Presidents Kennedy and de Gaulle today began a discussion of the future of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Taking time out to address the NATO Council itself, Mr. Kennedy made 2 points. First, that the United States is totally involved in the destiny of Western Europe. Second, that NATO must enlarge its role and concern itself with the security of all the southern half of the world, in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where the communist enemy is making such serious advances. Since France is the essential heart of NATO, the attitude of the French president is of crucial importance. While de Gaulle supports NATO, he does not view its growth as an alternative to the promotion of French national interests and power. At a state dinner last night, replying to Mr. Kennedy's words of high praise, the French president said, "Our common enterprise, peace with liberty, requires from both of us a reciprocal recognition as complete as possible in the conception of policy as well as its execution." To de Gaulle, such intimate consultations between the United States and France, as with Britain, on the conception of policy would not be a sidetracking of NATO. It would be the essential step toward strengthening that body. American officials in Paris say that Mr. Kennedy has offered to consult closely with de Gaulle before taking major action anywhere in the world on matters involving the Cold War. But they say Mr. Kennedy did not accept the proposal, which is said to be in a memorandum given by de Gaulle to the United States and Britain in 1958, proposing a three-power super-border strategy to run NATO. This memorandum has never been published. The French officials deny flatly that it contained any such proposition. They say that what de Gaulle wanted is exactly what he repeated last night, and which Mr. Kennedy appears to have accepted. If so, the Paris meeting may prove a considerable success. This is David Wills.
Let's face it, it was tough going in Paris on this, the first day of June and the second day of the Kennedy-de Gaulle talks. To begin with, it was another threatening, cloudy day. Then President de Gaulle didn't show up when President Kennedy addressed the municipal leaders of Paris at the Hotel de Ville. He had been conspicuously present when President Eisenhower had performed the same chore on his visit. There was a semi-official explanation that de Gaulle's absence today was due to the fact that the Kennedy visit was only classified as official, while Eisenhower came on a state visit. While the reporters were pondering this hair-splitting diplomatic difference, General de Gaulle played hooky again on the afternoon when President Kennedy addressed the Council of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. His absence this time was not entirely unexpected, as France, while a NATO member, is practically a member in absentia, having dispatched most of her military forces elsewhere. To top the whole day off, when Presidential Press Secretary Salinger was trying to explain all this to a couple of hundred reporters, the public address system collapsed and much of the briefing was lost in the confusion. Some facts stood out of today's activities. The two presidents discussed the problems of the whole free world. President Kennedy seems to think that everybody's problems should be shared by the bigger nations. Following tomorrow's talk, President Kennedy will hold a conference with his top advisors who are arriving from all directions. Rusk from the United States, Harriman from Geneva, and Thompson from Moscow. He leaves the scene of confusion for a genuine menace in Vienna early Saturday morning. This is Bill Henry in Paris.
A prominent nuclear and space scientist presented his views today on the question of whether the proposed U.S. program for placing a man on the moon is worth the price. And while his remarks were carefully worded, the only conclusion which can be drawn from them is that he doubts it. The scientist was Dr. Ralph E. Lapp, who has participated in many of the most important U.S. scientific projects over the past two decades. He presented his views to the Washington Academy of Sciences. The total cost of putting a man on the moon has been estimated at between $20 and $40 billion. In discussing the project today, Dr. Lapp took $25 billion as a convenient figure for the purposes of the discussion. On that basis, Dr. Lapp said, the cost per mile for the moon trip would be about $100,000, just about the same amount it costs to construct a mile of good highway here on Earth. He said, there are no reliable standards on which to base a judgment as to the moonshot's value. But he then stated that if the scientists of the country had $25 billion to spend, they would not spend it on a trip to the moon, but rather would spread it over many research programs of other kinds. He said the administration decision to go ahead with the project was political, not scientific. Dr. Lapp also doubted that there will be much for the first U.S. moon man to do, even if he succeeds in reaching there by the scheduled date of 1970. He thinks much of the moon research already will have been done by that time by relatively cheap and reliable instruments which can be sent to the moon even now. That's the opinion of one respected scientist on our enormously expensive plan for putting a man on the moon.
The State Department is seriously concerned about what it calls extreme measures of unwarranted repression slapped down in the Dominican Republic. It appears to be a revengeful policy aimed at everyone who may not have been in sympathy with the 31-year-old dictatorship, and not a mere matter of ferreting out the perpetrators of the assassination. Diplomatic circles fear these new repressions may be the orders of Major General Rafael Trujillo Jr., the new commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Most informed observers feel that the rise to power of the 32-year-old playboy could turn out to be the most fateful and the most unfortunate move that has been made since the death of the Generalissimo. The young general has never been popular, even with the most important supporters of his late father. He has shown no capacity for leadership or serious responsibility, and he certainly inspires little confidence or respect outside of the country. The government of President Balaguer and the military would have been much more likely to bridge the gap and ease the nation toward less despotic ways. The rise of the young Trujillo is an unmistakable attempt to perpetuate the dynasty, the family, and it will further enrage the opposition. This can only result in unnecessary turmoil. The State Department and leaders in the Organization of American States sense this responsibility. A few hours ago, the State Department called on the OAS to send an investigating team to the Dominican Republic to prevent further bloodshed. President Ramila Betancourt of Venezuela has called for an urgent meeting of the hemisphere body. This is Edward Tomlinson.
After his talks with President de Gaulle, President Kennedy says he has increased confidence as he moves tomorrow to Vienna to meet Khrushchev. He bases this confidence on what he and de Gaulle consider the highly satisfactory outcome of their meeting. President Kennedy cited to reporters today some of the potential strengths of the West in the conflict with communism. With American aid, Western Europe has staged a fantastic economic recovery from the war's destruction. Forgetting ancient rivalries, it is engaged in an historic movement toward economic and political unity. By wise policies, Britain and France are rapidly converting their empires into free associations of independent nations. On the communist side, Soviet Russia has gained nuclear weapons that destroy the former U.S. atomic monopoly and encourage the Reds to test and probe and push the West. But because of the extraordinary rebirth of Western European strength, the Reds have switched their threat to the southern half of the globe and are relying on subversion as their weapon instead of massed land armies. Mr. Kennedy moves to Vienna confident that this new threat can be thwarted if, by full cooperation and wise policies, the West mobilizes its assets to fulfill its responsibilities. Khrushchev is waiting in Vienna, where he says he hopes relations between the Soviet Union and the West can be built on a firm basis of peace and positive cooperation. This sounds like the same spirit that prevailed in Paris. In fact, it is a deliberate camouflage for the aggressive ambitions of communism. It would be unrealistic to expect Mr. Kennedy's words to change Khrushchev's convictions of inevitable communist victory at this time. But it is his belief that if the West unitedly meets the challenge, communism will be stopped no matter what Khrushchev thinks. This is David Wills.
President Kennedy this afternoon finished his talks with General de Gaulle full of good humor and confidence regarding his upcoming meeting with Khrushchev. It was another rainy day, not good going for anybody, particularly for five dashing Paris motorcycle police who piled up in a sort of Indianapolis Speedway-type crash at Saint-Cloud as they were escorting President Kennedy back from a visit to the Shape military headquarters this morning. The impression here is that no matter how strenuously and successfully or unsuccessfully our president may have battled for closer cooperation from General de Gaulle, this struggle has been just a warm-up for the weekend tussle ahead. No matter what his mood, and there's ample reason to expect it to be ugly, Nikita Khrushchev is a formidable opponent, and one not to be taken cheaply. President Kennedy seems fully aware of this, and this evening, with the majestic phrases of de Gaulle's classic French still echoing in his ears, the heavy planning for the Vienna contest is underway. The presidential sparring partner is working with him tonight to make him razor sharp for the heavyweight diplomatic battle of the century, includes some of our best talent. Secretary of State Dean Rusk, a seasoned strategist, has hustled in overnight from Washington. Averill Harriman, somewhat battle-weary from several weeks of hand-to-hand diplomatic sparring in Geneva, is full of first-hand tips on the latest Soviet tactics. Ambassador Thompson, fresh from Moscow, is here to tell the president exactly what Khrushchev told him the other day about the problems that he'd like to settle. Mr. Kennedy will certainly not lack for advice. This is Bill Henry in Paris.
New York Congressman William Miller took over the chairmanship of the Republican Party today, serving notice that the Kennedy administration can expect no soft treatment. He lost no time in declaring war on the administration's handling of domestic and foreign problems. Miller told the party's national committee that if the United States had a parliamentary system, there would be a resounding vote of no confidence in the administration. Miller was elected to head the party by unanimous vote after State Chairman Ray Bliss of Ohio bowed out of the race. Miller promised he will not use the office to promote any one of the prospective presidential candidates. He said unless the GOP can make gains at the lower levels, the presidential nomination in 64 won't be worth very much to anyone. Miller said Republicans should speak up on foreign policy issues while the programs are being formed. He said the party should take a firm position now against admitting Red China to the United Nations. He also opposed the tractor for prisoner trade proposed by Cuban dictator Castro. He said if ransom is to be paid, we should think of the millions behind the Iron Curtain. We cannot afford to build up the strength of our enemies by the payment of ransom. Miller predicted that Republicans will win control of the House of Representatives next year and will make gains in the Senate. The new chairman began his career as a district attorney under former New York Governor Thomas E. Dewey. In his 11 years in Congress, he has earned a reputation as a rough-and-tumble campaigner, a good phrase-maker, and a skillful organizer. He is the first Catholic to hold the chairmanship in this century. As last year's chairman of the House Campaign Committee, he chalked up a gain of 22 House seats while the Republicans were losing the White House. This is Ned Brooks.
Scientists are continuing their discussions of the proposed U.S. program for putting a man on the moon at an estimated cost of somewhere between $20 and $40 billion. And here and there are voices of doubt that the project is worth the price. Yesterday, we reported some reservations on the part of Dr. Ralph E. Lapp, the prominent nuclear physicist. Today, United Press International reports that Dr. Philip Abelson, director of the Geophysical Laboratory of the Carnegie Institution and president of the Washington Academy of Sciences, holds similar views. Dr. Abelson, like Dr. Lapp, doubts that so much money should be spent putting a man on the moon when lunar exploration could be conducted at a fractional cost by electronic instruments. Scientists, quite naturally, can be expected to be much more eager for a moon probe than laymen, because of their interest in any new field of knowledge. So when they start doubting the value of the program, we have only a taste of what is to come when congressional committees, which will have to vote the funds, start toting up the costs. When the congressmen are faced with the startling fact that the moon trip may cost more than it costs to build our entire railway system, and perhaps nearly half the value of all the nation's farmlands, they may begin to have some serious doubts as to where we are going and why.